Hello and welcome to S&P Global Ratings Fixed Income in 15 podcast, a 15-minute chat with a fixed income investor and an S&P ratings analyst. My name is Joe Cass. I'm a director in market outreach. Today I'm joined by S&P's global head of credit research, Alexandra Dmitrievich, and a man touted as Britain's best-known bond investor, M&G's head of fixed interest, Jim Leavis. Hello, Alexandra, and hello, Jim.
Hello.
Okay, let's jump straight in. Jim, I'm going to start with some questions for you. What major trends are you seeing in the global fixed income market today?
Hi, well, I think the biggest thing that's going on is that we're trading around record yields pretty much everywhere in the world in government bond space. Credit spreads look incredibly tight on a global and historical basis as well. But at the same time, if you're looking for justification for both of those things, we've got the resumption of quantitative easing and extraordinary monetary policy in the Eurozone, and we're potentially heading back into trade wars, global downturn, and all of those things that could justify the fact that rates are around zero and heading lower in the rest of the world.
So to pick up on some of the points you just mentioned, this summer, around 30% of bonds issued by governments and companies worldwide were trading at negative yields. However, yields have recently started to creep up. Is the global bull run in bonds finally over?
This is something that gets asked every January in every thought piece from every investment bank. You know, this is the year to sell all your bonds and buy equities, and pretty much every year for the past 30 years, that's not been the right thing to do. So as an investor, I'm incredibly cautious in saying that, you know, a 15 basis point back up in 10-year yields is the end of what's been a 30-year secular down move in bond yields. I think we have to accept the fact that the big demographic changes in developed markets around aging populations, the things going on around technology pushing down inflation, and of course globalization, which didn't start with China joining the WTO back at the start of the millennium, but obviously that's one of the significant trends. All of those things still exist. And as a result of that, I think you could probably expect bond yields to stay low for a very long time, unless somebody decides to press the red button marked fiscal policy and starts borrowing heavily to do something. And of course, on top of that, you've got the potential threat that globalization is under threat in itself.
So moving to Europe, the ECB have decided to launch another asset purchase program, and they're now planning to buy billions in new securities per month for an indefinite period of time. What sort of impact will a potential QE infinity have on the investment community?
Yeah, I mean, the ECB has a stated goal to have inflation in the Eurozone at or slightly below 2%. And if you look at core inflation in the Eurozone, it's stuck around 1%. And I don't think anyone believes that even with QE infinity, they're likely to get that back up towards 2% anytime soon. And in fact, the market's pricing in no rate rises for almost a decade in the Eurozone. So the question is QE even effective anymore? And there's been lots of academic studies, and we look at them all, the kind of meta studies of looking at QE 1, 2 and 3 in the US, and then looking at Eurozone, Bank of England, QE, etc., etc. And they show massive diminishing returns. So there's a big bang for your buck in advance of QE as people start speculating about it. But if you look at QE 1, 2 and 3 in the States, the impact on bond yields halved every time effectively after that. So I think that to expect this to ride to the rescue of the Eurozone and boost inflation to any meaningful extent is asking too much. But having said that, it will keep bond yields low. And perhaps the biggest impact you'll see is on the corporate bond markets, which are slightly less liquid, as we know. And if the ECB is an ongoing buyer of all those European corporate names, that's going to keep credit spreads low too.
One interesting element of the ECB's new purchase program is the removal of the yield floor, which means that they're now permitted to buy corporate bonds yielding less than minus 0.5% from November onwards. Is this going to have a material impact on portfolios, or is this just the ECB sending a signal that they are willing to support high quality credit irrespective of the yield environment?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. They're just going to buy and buy until they get inflation up. And they're going to see what works for the transmission mechanism. Does buying negative yielding bonds provoke corporates to issue more debt and then do something useful with the debt? And really, that's been the missing bit of the puzzle. Presumably, most European corporates can do something productive that hopes to generate a return that's greater than minus 0.5%. And if that's the case, then they should do it. They should be borrowing at minus numbers, those bonds ending up in the hands of the ECB, and then they can go out and build the factories and employ people and do something productive to get European growth going again. And that's really what's needed. So the ECB will do whatever it takes, and we've got Christine Lagarde coming to take over from Draghi, and she seems to be as dovish as Mario Draghi was, so expect more of the same.
Alexandra, S&P Global Ratings have just released a credit conditions report, a quarterly report that reviews global macroeconomic conditions, identifying credit risk and their potential ratings impact in various asset classes. Would you be able to provide an overview of the key takeaways of the EMEA report?
Yes, Joe, indeed. We just released the report for this quarter, and what we see is actually some pressure mounting on credit quality in Europe as a result of the combination of different factors. One is slowdown in economic growth across all of the major economies, the US, China, and Europe. The second factor is a build-up on some of the political and trade tension, which I can come back on. And the third one, which is more structural, is the effect on the ongoing tech disruption, which is starting to impact a number of sectors. So although, as we discussed with Jim just before, the ECB has gone all in to shore up growth and prevent a recession, we continue to see that the European economy is largely dependent on export and therefore remains vulnerable to some external shocks, which could come from further escalation in the trade tensions between China and the US, but also directly between the US and Europe, as we've seen just over the weekend, or oil shocks, as well as we've seen in the past couple of weeks. But the other point that I wanted to mention to bounce back on what Jim was saying is that there are indeed an increasing number of discussions on the impact of this monetary stimulus and whether that is sufficient or not to prevent at some point a turn in the economic cycle. And indeed, we even heard Draghi over the weekend talk about fiscal policy as a necessary complement. And from a credit standpoint, a persistent low interest rate environment isn't without posing risk. For instance, putting pressure on banks' profitability, also on the funding of pension liabilities for corporate. And it also creates an environment that might be conducive of further build-up in corporate leverage and more aggressive financial policy. So as Jim was saying, it all depends what the money is used for. Is it used to fund more capex and technology development, or maybe just more aggressive financial policy? And also for this quarter, political risks remain at the forefront. Obviously, here in the UK, with the increasingly vitriolic Brexit saga, so our base case is that of a deal at some point, but an extension from the end of October deadline. But geopolitical risk remain at the forefront. We mentioned the tension between the US and China, which in our view goes well beyond tariff to a more technology confrontation that is going to last. And all of this creates some greater market volatility, which is itself another risk.
A line in the report stood out for me, a Molotov cocktail for credit quality. So weaker growth and weaker credit trends seem to be dominant across the majority of asset classes in EMEA. What major risks does the report identify?
So first, let's not be too alarmist, I think. So indeed, I mentioned just before a number of negative trends. That says, even though these vulnerabilities are building up, our base case remains for the rest of 2019 and 2020 is that of a slower economic growth, but not a recession. And as well, although we see some more negative trend, our negative outlook bias is largest in 2013. But we still don't expect default rates to increase very significantly. Actually, we expect them to increase only marginally to 2.5% in the next 12 months. What I'd like to underline, though, is that there are certain sectors that are more vulnerable to these trends. Some sectors, such as capital goods or steel, for instance, are more vulnerable to a slowdown in global trade. But other sectors are also more vulnerable to the secular technology changes, for instance, in the retail or automotive. And the last point that I'd like to mention that we watch very carefully is the trends in the leveraged finance sector. We've seen deterioration or weakening of credit quality, particularly in the US, where we've seen a spike in the B minus and below rated credit, but also more generally in an environment of low rate and covlight. What this means is that weaker company might be able to survive for longer, but when the cycle turns, we think recovery might be lower. So that's the risk that we're watching.
Turning to a topic that's front of mind for many in the investment community at present, ESG. The impact of ESG on the investment community has been considerable. Earlier this year, S&P Global Ratings launched the ESG Evaluation, a data-driven assessment of an entity's ESG performance and preparedness. Jim, how is the rise of ESG sentiment affecting the bond markets, and what do you think the future of ESG in investment could be?
I think it's become the hot topic in bond markets. I think it's become almost a hygiene factor. So if you want to pitch for business, you have to have ESG embedded deeply in your organisation. So you're not going to win any new mandates in Scandinavia or France or Benelux unless ESG is a core part of your process now. And so for us, we've got 40 credit analysts in London, and ESG is, you know, a core part of what they do when they analyse the fundamentals of a company, both because it's the right thing to do for a moral and ethical point of view, but also because it makes a difference in whether your bond's going to do well and pay you back. So governance, I think, has always been part of what credit analysts do, but now the other factors have become much more important too. I think that we have to be very mindful about, Mark Carney at the Bank of England has talked about stranded assets and the fact that if we're thinking very long term for our bond investors, might there come a time when, you know, oil companies are going to be left with all these assets still under the ground without any demand for them? So there is a real economic need to consider the long-term prospects and the drive to more sustainable energy. When we think about the sector as a whole, I think there will be different types of funds. So there'll be funds that make exclusions, for instance, thermal coal or cigarettes and so forth. But then there'll be, and that will do for some people, that's a kind of assets that some people will be happy with, just excluding sectors they're uncomfortable with. But there'll also be a load of funds launched that aim to do good as well, aim to have a positive impact on the world and on the climate emergency and things like that. So there'll be a whole range of new funds available for people who want to take those kind of views.
Another interesting topic close to home is employee diversity within financial services. Our research shows how increasing the number of women in the workforce could boost GDP growth and add close to $6 trillion to global market capitalization within 10 years. Jim, what's been your experience of employee diversity within the asset management industry over the past 25 years? How far has the industry come, and how much more work needs to be done?
You're right about workforce participation, and, you know, look at Japan, for instance, where it's one of Abe, the Prime Minister's key goals is to increase female participation, and in fact, it's increased to such an extent it's now higher than in the UK or in the United States. So it is a key driver if you want to sustain positive growth rates in the future. So governments need to do more, and of course, as we all know, the asset management industry needs to do more. We have 30% of my team on the fund management side are women, but, and I know that's quite good compared to the rest of the industry, but it's still not good enough. A lot of fund management jobs are dead man's shoes, literally. You know, people don't leave the industry very often. It's a not many fund managers are employed, so vacancies don't come up as often as you'd like them to. We can't have positive discrimination legally, so it's quite difficult to have, for instance, an all-female shortlist. That might be something you could do to increase the number of women. So you have to really encourage applicants, and that's really what we're aiming to do in order to carry on increasing percentage of women in the workforce.
Alexandra, you contributed to a piece published in March this year entitled The Financial Future is Female, which discussed how women are transforming financial markets and economies across the globe. Were there any stark data points that stood out for you from this research?
So indeed, at S&P Global, through our Change Pace campaign, we are very committed to promoting diversity. And I'm proud to be the chair of the S&P Global Women Research Council. And what we do is really harness the data and expertise that we have across the divisions of our company to produce research and advance the discussion around the benefit of an increased female participation. So in that particular report, The Financial Future is Female, we found that women's role as investors in the financial market has increased substantially. They actually hold as much as 40% of the world's total wealth. But we also found that there's still some way to go to make women more confident investors. They generally tend to be more cautious about their financial future, and only a minority invest in a capital market. One positive note, though, and coming back on the previous point on ESG, is that this survey shows that women are on average 10% more likely than men to take into account ESG factors when making an investment decision. So they could contribute to a more sustainable future of the world, but still some way to go, in particular at the C-suite level.
To finish, there's a couple of non-market related questions. So Jim, to start with you, on top of your day job, you are also the editor of M&G's famous Bond Vigilantes blog, and you run their popular Twitter account. So what sort of response do you receive from the market? And have you received, let's say, any unusual responses to the blog?
Yeah, I mean, we've run the blog for over a decade now, from just before the great financial crisis, and it's really interesting to look back and see what kind of things we were looking at over time. So I think that the market and our competitors and the investment banks, etc., and people that follow us find it quite interesting as a debating platform, and we say interesting things. We don't talk about our funds on there, so that gives us a bit of freedom, you know, because we're just talking about general things that keep us interested rather than saying buy this fund because it's great. And I think that's why it's proved to be so popular over the years. It can be sometimes controversial, and yeah, I've had some hideous responses when I suggested that physical cash might be faded away over time because otherwise you can't use negative interest rates. And yeah, I had to turn off my personal Twitter account for a couple of years after that, after the American Tea Party got involved. But apart from that, it's all been good.
So Jim, just to finish, what's your top finance or business book recommendation?
Good question. I think the one that I keep coming back to is a book called Against the Gods by Peter Bernstein, which is a history of risk going all the way back to thousands of years. And I think that's well worth a read for anybody interested in markets.
So Alexandra, same question for you.
For me, the Fourth Industrial Revolution from Klaus Schwab, the founder of the World Economic Forum. I think this book is really an eye-opener on the exponential pace and the extent of the changes that are taking place related to all of these new technologies, AI, quantum computing, Internet of Things, and so many others. And what I find revealing about it is a profound transformation that all of these changes are bringing and will bring not only to our economies, but to our societies.
Finally, Jim, you are a Nottingham Forest fan. So will we be seeing the Reds return to top flight football anytime soon?
Well, we briefly went top of the Championship last week, so you never know. I guess the question is, at what cost? And if it's at the cost of being owned by a dictator or an oligarch, or at the cost of going bankrupt through spending too much money just in the hope of getting a season of top flight football, I'd rather stay in the division we're at, playing good football now for a change.
Well, thank you, Jim, and thank you, Alexandra, for your comments today.
Thank you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Fixed Income in 15.